A woman came in to talk to me about her marriage just a few months ago, telling me how terrible her husband was and really being able to list off a number of things that were horrible about him. I was speaking to her yesterday and she said, "Wow, I found out it isn't about my husband. The issues are so much about me." She'd come to a place where she'd had the opportunity to see, to take off some of her blinders, and to finally be able to see the truth about herself and about her husband and about her life, and to start them loving her husband.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband Larry, she is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
Sometimes, Jack, I find myself in no man's land. On one hand, I'm a Christian who very much wants to follow and obey God and what He's asking us to do in our lives, and very, very serious about that. And I am also a counselor. Lots of times people see those as being contradictory to one another, that I can't both be wanting to be obedient to God and helping people with their emotional, psychological, relational life. For lots of people, that just doesn't go together in our culture. Also, I'm rather conservative for the psychological community, and I'm rather liberal for the church community. So I find myself kind of in a very distinct and unique position very often.
You say liberal with respect to the Christian community. What? How so?
Well, very often just that I'm a counselor. Very many times people think that counselors, for example, shouldn't get paid, that any counseling that people receive should be strictly out of the Bible, reading their Bible, going to church, talking to their pastor, or through friendships, and that counselors have no place in our community. And very often, as a matter of fact, I see Christians who have tried all those avenues. They've gone to their pastor, they've gone to friends, they've really earnestly tried to seek help, sometimes even lay counseling ministries at different churches, and the people just aren't equipped to deal with the level of pain or the level of trauma that they've experienced, or the relational issues that they're trying to work with. For example, keep a marriage together. They just haven't been able to find that kind of help, and they feel guilty coming to a counselor, feeling like this is really wrong, it's really disobedient to God, but I just don't have anywhere else to go, and so this is the very last straw.
What I would suspect, let me say something controversial here, what I would suspect, however, is that what you offer is not that you're a counselor and the pastor was not a counselor, but rather that you offer an entirely different perspective on what the Christian faith is all about and how the Christian faith, what the implications of the Christian faith are for the particular problems that your counselees are dealing with.
I didn't get the very first. You said I'm not like the pastor, or I am similar to the pastor in that I'm trying to help them see their faith in a particular way.
No, what I'm saying is the reason the counselees did not get help when they went to their pastor or lay counseling ministry at the church was not because they lacked counseling training, but because they lacked biblical training. That is, their view, their concept of what the Bible has to say to us about what life is all about and who God is and who we are and how we are to relate to God and the various perspectives that you would want to lead people into are not perspectives that those people are equipped with. They have such a different concept of what the Christian faith is all about, one that ultimately can't help the people that you're counseling.
You're right. That's really controversial, Jack. Thanks a lot. You know, I just can't make a sweeping statement. But what I will say is, I think there's a lot of people who understand Scripture in terms of what you should do and what you shouldn't do. They use it very behaviorally. What I mean by that is, if you have a problem, then what you do is you go to the Scripture and you find the directive and you just do it. And so it's very black and white. For example, if children aren't obeying their parents, what the counselor or the Christian might say is point the child to the verse in the Bible that says, obey your parents, and that's simply what should happen. Parents who are having a difficult time learning how to discipline their children, they're told to go to the Bible, and it says, spare the rod, spoil the child. And so what they hear is, you're just supposed to spank your children, and that's just kind of the answer to the problem. Now, that's very simplistic, but I think too often we get really black and white. We get really simplistic with what the Scriptures have for us. And yes, I do very much come from a different perspective than that. There is a lot of gray area that's not very clearly identified in terms of what we should be doing in our lives. The biggest commandment, perhaps, in terms of our relationships is that we're supposed to love one another, that we're supposed to forgive one another. Those two things are incredibly important, but how do you define them? It becomes very difficult to understand what those things mean in the context of our inner relationships and in terms of our internal relationship with ourselves. What exactly do those things mean? If we define it in a very simple way, I think we're missing the vast majority of what God is speaking to us through the Bible. And, yeah, I think there's a lot of people that are ill-equipped to really understand the depth of what that means. I think it's scary to understand it because it becomes an issue of having to be wise, an issue of having to think things through, an issue of not having things black and white so that it's very clear and very easy and very straightforward. It is a difficult thing to work through relationships, to work through relationships with myself and with other people. And, people get scared of it.
Yeah, it sounds like you're supporting what I was saying because...
Well, I'm supporting what you're saying in a sense, Jack, but I really don't want to be critical of any particular pastors or as a sweeping statement say...
No, of course not. No.
Most pastors don't understand the Scriptures. I can't say that. What I'd like to say is if they understand it in that way, I think they're really not giving the meat of the Scriptures.
Right. Yeah, what I meant by that is there just is a right way and a wrong way to approach the Bible. And a wrong way to approach the Bible is to assume that the Bible is some kind of little answer book so that you turn to page 53 and you'll get an answer to how you should conduct yourself in this particular situation that you're in. There is a whole subculture, there's a whole tendency, a whole current in Christian culture today that would like the Bible to be that sort of book. But if we have read the Bible and taken it seriously, and what I mean by taking it seriously is not tried to see there what it is we want to see there, but let it speak to us on its own terms, I think it becomes readily apparent rather quickly that it's not that sort of book. That's not what it is. And that in coming to terms seriously with what the Bible is saying, part of what the Bible is telling us is that we are inherently foolish people who need to become wise. And it's a story about how the good news is God has a plan for calling out a people to himself, making them wise, and then ultimately making them good and glorious people in the kingdom to come. That's what the Bible's message is. It's not recording the wisdom that everybody would need in any and every situation. It's just simply telling us what our problem is, the source of our foolishness, and talking about the promise of God to take us into a process of sanctification whereby we will become wise. But the wisdom is stuff that we learn through life experience, as God teaches us, as God guides us, as we think deeply about our lives and honestly, and without running from the truth, we face the truth of our lives, that's where we become wise. There's nothing simplistic about the wisdom that the Bible thinks we need. It's not trite, it's not formulaic, it's not, you know, it's not just one little dictum here or a sentence here is going to solve all of my problems. That's certainly not the perspective of the Bible, I think. So in that regard, if we as a Christian community take the attitude that, well, there's some verse somewhere that's going to be the answer to every marital problem or every disciplinary problem between children and their parents, then we obviously haven't taken the Bible very seriously, I would argue.
And that I would very much agree with you, and it also creates more problems in our lives if we think that's true. Because if we think that there's some formula, for example, of how to do friendships well, and yet we can't seem to do our friendships very well, we just see ourselves as complete failures and as perhaps just being disobedient to God or wondering why God isn't making it all better for us. Or the same with marriage, or the same with raising children. I think particularly with raising children, people seem to think, gosh, if I just had the formula, if I just was able to follow what God said, then it would all work out. And that's just not how it is. In fact, it seems to me that God uses a lot of difficulties of our lives. Those are the things in and which we grow up, in and through which we grow up. Not with the absence of problems. And I think that's really where a lot of Christians go. How can I just get rid of the problems rather than how can I grow through them?
Right. We've probably talked about this before, but that's the underlying problem that is so wrong, so diabolical, really, is the notion that the point of Jesus coming into the world was to make my life here and now successful, full of blessing, rich and full and with no problems and no sorrow and no suffering. And that just couldn't be further from the truth. That's not his agenda. That's not his intention. That's not why he came. He came that we might have life eternal, and that is to be gained by us being marked with the wisdom of God here and now on this earth. But the wisdom of God comes through suffering, through pain, through sorrow, through facing into a reality that is ultimately futile. That's ultimately empty and unsatisfying. So why is my life unsatisfying? Not because I'm not doing it right. It's unsatisfying because life is unsatisfying. That's why. We were made for something bigger and beyond, and we have to come to terms with that and learn to see that.
Well, I think that's too big of a statement, Jack. I would say that one of the reasons our life is unsatisfying is because God didn't set it up so that we would have everything perfect, but through the imperfections, through the difficulties, we could grow up. And also through the good things, also through the loving things, through relationships that are very nurturing, we grow up. So it comes from both sides. But ultimately, our lives aren't that satisfying because even at its best, there's a whole lot more that we kind of yearn for in our hearts that's not available here. That's what you're saying.
Right.
But then there's this other side, and part of the reason my life isn't satisfying is because very often, a couple of reasons, but one is what we've just talked about, that I might approach the scripture with this idea that life should just be abundantly wonderful, and I should just have joy and peace all the time, and it's just a misunderstanding of what really is being offered to us. So I keep on being disappointed because I'm not getting what I think I should, or incredibly guilty because I should be having this happy, abundant, fruit-filled, always good life, and I'm not. So I must be doing something very wrong, or maybe God's letting me down would be another option. But you know, there's another side, and that's that lots of people, there is an extent to which we can have a lot of fulfillment, satisfaction, joy, peace, lots of love in our life, and sometimes people really are blocked from being able to go there because they haven't learned how to work with their emotional lives, with their relational lives, or perhaps they've had an incredible amount of trauma, or, well, in every family, there's sin. We are all dysfunctional families from that perspective, and so whatever sin that we've encountered in our lives, through our families, through our schooling, through our friendships, through the world around us as we grow up, we carry that with us. And if we don't know how to deal with or work with that at all, to the extent that life can be satisfying, it isn't. So I think it's both those things.
I'm sorry, both what? Both.
It's not satisfying because it's not being offered. The Bible never says you're going to have this great, wonderful, perfect life, and that's just not offered until heaven. But we think maybe it should be, and so we're disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
We're unsatisfied.
Right. That's one.
That's
right.
One.
Okay.
The other side is I bring with me experiences of my lifetime, and if I'm not able to deal with or know how to work with or manage my emotional, internal emotional life or my relational life, I end up with a very unsatisfying life also.
So more unsatisfying than it would have to be,
is what
you're saying.
That's right.
Okay.
Saying. And that's what I do as a counselor. I help people see both sides. What is it that God's really wanting or offering for our lives? What's that look like? And what are some of the issues that we brought with us from our experiences of life that keep us from being able to experience or work with what God has for us?
So relate what you're doing then as a counselor to something like the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself, or pick another commandment if you'd rather.
Well, I had someone recently come in and talk to me about a neighbor who was encroaching in on his property. He wanted to build something that was pretty much inside the property line of this other person, and of the person that came in and talked to me. And what he tried to do is work with that neighbor. He was really trying to be a kind, good neighbor to the other person, not exaggerate the problem, not create more problems, but try and work with the fact that this is their property and they have some, of course, some ideas about how they want their own property to be used, and also wants to be a kind person to their neighbor. So it was kind of a perplexing problem. So what he did was go over first and talk to his neighbor, and she was just completely unresponsive, pretty mean about it, said she was going to do what she wanted to do, and it didn't really matter what this man thought, just really wouldn't budge at all. And so what he did was just decide, you know, I think maybe this person, I know they're having some difficult time in their life right now. I think I'm just going to let it go for about a month, and then I'm going to go back and talk about it again, because sometimes people have, you know, hard days. And so he was really trying to give her the benefit of the doubt. So he waited about a month, went back, greeted her again. They sat down in their living room, and they'd been good neighbors up until this point. And he brought it up again, a little bit scared, a little bit tentative, but brought it up, and she was unbudging. In fact, she said to leave her house and never come back. She just wasn't willing to talk about it. So he was perplexed, and he came to me with this problem. I really want to be a good neighbor, and I have my property, and I really don't want it to be used in this way. So he thought that to be a good Christian, to be a good neighbor, meant he just had to allow that neighbor to, you know, use his property. And that's not at all what I think is a loving thing to do for that neighbor. The neighbor is being inappropriate and unkind, and to allow them just to kind of have their temper tantrum, it's very much like a small child. When we don't make any boundaries, they just have more and more and more tantrums. And it looks as though this woman has... And he had found out from other neighbors since then that she had kind of had, in a sense, these temper tantrums all over the neighborhood. And people were really intimidated by her. And so she had kind of made her own domain out of this whole neighborhood. And people were intimidated. So his question, the question that we came up with, was how do you be most loving to this person? Well, you have to draw some boundaries. What's that look like in this case? Well, what it looked like in this case was... there was an option. He said what I could do is I could just get all my other neighbors together, and we could, you know, really create a problem in her house. We could do some things that were kind of a nuisance. The police wouldn't be concerned about it, but we'd know that it was a problem. We would, you know, throw trash in our yard, or we would, you know, spoil some things and kind of booby trap. That was one idea that he wasn't interested in doing, but a neighbor had suggested that they do that. He said, I don't want to do that. So finally, the option that he came up with, was, which seemed most realistic, was to call the city and have the city work within the law to persuade this woman to stay within the law herself. Now, this man felt very bad about that. The city ended up moving in, requiring this woman do a whole lot of things that she had not been doing in the past. And she was very angry. She was very mean to the neighbors. And so this man was telling me, I must have done something wrong because she's so mean, because she's so angry, because she's telling me I'm such a bad person. Well, I don't think we can base, are we loving another person on their response to us. Very often we can be loving somebody and they just don't like not being able to do what they want to do, similar to a child. Child doesn't want boundaries. Well, ultimately they do. But they'd like to do what they want to do and get away with it. So that's just an example of how do you love your neighbor? Well, gosh, there's lots of different ways to love your neighbor.
So why does love set boundaries? Or let me put it this way, what's the difference between love and selfishness? Because selfishness sets boundaries too.
You've got me going with too many ideas, Jack. Love sets boundaries because I'm ultimately looking toward the best interest of the other person. And is it the best interest of the other person that they just learn to have temper tantrums and they never have to face in to what is true? What is right, what is loving, what is good. And that's ultimately the very most important thing somebody can do. Not what makes them feel good or feel happy, but what's good and what's right, and to have to face those questions. If he had been selfish, it would have looked more like not asking her to face into that. He would have not set boundaries and just been enraged and angry and resentful toward her, built that anger inside himself, and somehow it would have come out toward her anyway. But I think he was reluctant to do anything, not out of love, but out of selfishness, out of fear, actually. That was the bottom of his selfishness, about her response to him. And what he said to me was, see, it all turned out bad. And it took him a long time to understand, no, it didn't turn out bad. It turned out uncomfortable. It turned out difficult. But he got to face into his fears, and she had the opportunity to, with the boundary, decide if she wanted to pursue goodness or if she wanted to keep having temper tantrums. She decided to have temper tantrums, but she had the opportunity. It was in front of her. She had the information, which she hadn't been given before by the rest of the neighborhood. And had they booby-trapped her place, as some of the neighbors suggested, then she could have just been, I think she could have been justified or thought she was justified in her actions.
But I guess my point is that...
Did I not answer your question?
Well, Jeff? No, I think you did. But going to the city, I believe you said, or going...
The man actually...
Bringing authorities into it.
Right.
One could do that out of nothing but selfishness, or one could do that out of love. It seems to me that deep down, although the external action is the same, it's what's deep down that is really makes the difference. And what you're saying is that love does what it does, keeping in mind the ultimate best interests of the other person. And just giving in many situations is not because I have the ultimate best interests of the other person in view, but rather I have my own tranquility and peace in my life in view. That is, I want to just kind of keep things as...
Make it as easy as I possibly can.
Make it as easy as I can, and giving in is one way to keep things easy. But
ultimately, it's not.
Right. Yeah, that's true too.
But on the surface, it really feels that way, and it certainly felt that way to him.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I really agree with you. It's not the action in and of itself. One person could go to the city, and it'd be a really inappropriate action. Another person may not. Or may go, and it would be very appropriate. It really depends. And that's why I was talking about the Bible not being black and white. It's very gray. What does love look like in this particular situation? It's a hard thing to figure out a lot of the time.
Right. And you can't capture it in a commandment or a counsel or a proverb, because if it ultimately depends upon the state of my heart, my deep down motives, my agenda, my purposes, then to say love does good to a neighbor, and anyone who's doing good to a neighbor is loving their neighbor, I'm clueless. I really don't understand what's going on in life if I think that my good deeds make me loving. They don't. My good deeds can be really, really evil, really self-serving, really greedy, really manipulative, really disrespectful to other people. And the Bible can't give me the eyes to see that. It has to be the Spirit of God, as He works in my life through experience, to give me the kind of discernment, the kind of eyes to see what's going on underneath the surface in my own life and in others.
I think people might have a question about that, so let me put an example on what you said.
Okay.
You were saying that it could be really wrong for me to be a very helpful neighbor, a very good neighbor. I don't think you're using the word good in terms of the ultimate good, but I might be I used the word helpful. That was my word. I might go and bring dinners to other people. I might bring them flowers. I might serve them in a number of different ways. To the people who are being served, they may experience that as a really good thing and a really helpful thing. But I'm thinking about a situation where I worked with a woman who did that all the time. Her home was a mess. Her home, in terms of it just wasn't kept up, and her children were pretty much running around on their own because she was so involved in helping other people. Her marriage was falling apart, but she was really seen as the ideal person in her community. People really thought she was great, and she was demanding enough and controlling enough of her children that they were really staying in line, but that wasn't really what was going on with them at all. So I think that's a great example of what you were just talking about. It could appear like she's being a good neighbor. She's not. Ultimately, she's being a bad neighbor to everybody that is around her in her life, because she is not doing what she's supposed to be committed to be doing first.
And you can even do good toward other people in terms that is not, where it's not experienced as helpful. It's experienced as intrusive or oppressive, because it's not about serving me. It's about some agenda that you, the doer of the good deeds, has that is very self-serving ultimately. That to love other people means to become discerning about what would genuinely be helpful to them and on their terms, you know, would be perceived as helpful to them. A lot of good is done on my terms. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's helpful to them or not.
So there's two scenarios. I can be a friend where, for example, I'm giving dinners and they experience it as great, but I'm only doing it because I want them to think I'm great.
Right.
Or this next example is I could be giving things to people, but be over-giving in a sense, be invasive, intrusive.
Insensitively giving.
Insensitively giving, yeah. In a way that I really think is great, but I'm doing it maybe because it builds my ego. It makes me feel as though I'm really being a serving person, and I need to have that perspective of myself.
Right.
But I'm not at all doing that. I think I used, when I first became a counselor, I was really into, you know, trying to be a good listener to people. And I think that that was kind of invasive. It was about me wanting to show that I could listen well, rather than it being an appropriate situation all the time. And so at this point, lots of times, or give counsel, and I have really backed off. I mean, it's very... I think sometimes even people could see me as not being very wise or very bright or very astute or very even capable of listening well, because I work so hard outside the counseling room to not offer it to people unless they ask. In fact, I often go the other direction and get a little careless and flippant. You've seen that. Kind of throw things, kind of just be light, because people don't want that kind of... It is experienced as an invasion unless they're asking for it.
Right, right. So my initial question to you was, so how in your counseling are you, how would you relate that to something like a commandment to love your neighbor? Let me see if I can summarize the answer. The problem with a commandment like love your neighbor is, whereas it may seem simple enough and clear enough, here's this, just in black and white, all you have to do is love your neighbor. The problem with that is we start off being very, very inherently self-centered, selfish, foolish, self-serving creatures with our own agenda that has nothing to do with the goodness that God created us for.
And I would say often also uneducated, just not knowing a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. I mean, just not even informed.
Correct.
And what's required in order for us to know how to obey a commandment like that, what's required is we have to live some life, face into the experience of life honestly, truthfully, without hiding, without ducking, without dodging the uncomfortable implications that has for my own self-concept and my own perspective on myself. And in the process of doing that, I learn through life experience what it really means to be loving, what it would really mean to love my neighbor. So part of what you're doing is coaching and guiding people, inviting them to take a look at the information from their own life that could and would teach them the things that they need to know about what it means to love another person.
Yeah.
Does that characterize what you're doing?
Yeah, that characterizes a lot of what I'm doing. But to help people look at the information of their own lives is a very loaded issue.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because what we don't want to do usually is to look at things that are painful, and often the information of our own lives is very painful, and we're trying to avoid that. It's very hard to get people to look at what they're trying so hard to avoid, because it seems to them that their avoidance is the same as their survival.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're talking about something much more, much deeper and more complex than this, but at a very simple level, when I read a commandment as a child, as a young adult growing up, and I read a commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, my immediate reaction, and I think I'm not any different than anybody else in the world, my immediate reaction is to go, what does that mean? Well, that's like what I do. Our automatic assumption is that we are basically kind people, we are basically decent people, and basically loving people, therefore. So loving my neighbor is to do, you know, kind of what I do. Well, that's not...
And I kind of don't want to learn a whole lot more because I'm already kind of doing it well.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, to actually face into the possibility that loving my neighbor would be a radically different way of relating to my neighbor than what comes naturally to me is, I resist that with like crazy. That's not the pride in me, that the innate sinful pride in me does not want to see myself as somebody who does not know how to love. And yet, from a biblical perspective, that's exactly why the Bible is saying what it's saying and doing what it's doing, describing what it's describing, is because it wants me to come to terms with the fact that I fall desperately short of being the kind of person who loves my neighbor. And will I come to terms with that reality? Will I come to terms with the fact that that's true and enter into a discipleship with Jesus where I can learn to do it differently? I can learn to have different values than the ones that come naturally. And that's in the least complicated of scenarios. Then when you add on to that the dimension of my very survival depending upon me not looking at some truths about my life, then it gets even deeper and more complicated and harder.
So what you're saying is we always, even in the best of circumstances, have a real innate tendency to not want to look at the truth about our lives,
right,
and not want to see ourselves as really having any negative influences on the people around us, or any making any wrong decisions, or doing anything that's very negative at all. I think theoretically we can say, yeah, I know I don't do it right all the time, but when it comes down to the individual issues that we may need to face into, we are really, really very resistant to that.
Yeah, just think in terms of how often when we see chaos around us, when we see alienation in relationship to other people, trauma of one kind in our relationships, how often it's, well, I was just misunderstood. I meant well. They just misunderstood my actions. They didn't. It, always shifting to the other people didn't respond right. Very seldom do we take seriously the possibility that maybe your sin was showing, Jack. You know, maybe that ugly, destructive stuff that's in all of us is manifesting itself in a way that that hurt other people and alienated them and damaged them and damaged your relationship.
Yeah, that's a problem I can think about having had with my husband over the years, is that I will have an intention that I believe is really good, and perhaps the intention is good, or the issue that I want to address is good, but the way I say it, he has talked about that a lot. And I'll get so lost in, but this is a really good issue. This is an important thing that we need to address. And he'll get lost in, Christine, you're being hard. Or some kind of attitude that I have that I really, honestly don't see. And it's taken me a lot of years to finally say, okay, there must be something about my attitude that I'm not knowing right now. Though now I can kind of pick up on it more. But he would say to me after years, when I would finally say, okay, Larry, there is probably something wrong with my attitude. What's going on? He'd say, you don't believe that. Because I didn't believe it for so long.
Because you didn't see it.
I just didn't see it.
Yeah.
But now I think I see it better. I see it more. And even sometimes when I don't see it, I really have to kind of believe him.
Mm-hmm.
That there is something that I'm not aware of that's going on in my attitude, the way that I'm communicating, maybe not the content of it. And I need to stop and hear that. Because very often it doesn't have to do with the content. It has to do with the delivery. It is true, Jack, that we very much want to blame people outside of ourselves for issues that are going on in our lives rather than look at our own contribution. And I think that's really the number one thing that we need to learn about our emotional lives, that I am responsible for a lot that goes on around me. And I need to be very willing to hear other people tell me that and take responsibility for it. Because what we want to do is to blame and to resist what's being communicated to us. I know in my counseling classes way back 25 years ago, they said people are going to come for help and they're going to resist it as hard at the same time as they possibly can. And I thought, okay, no big deal. I didn't really get the level of resistance that people would put forward. And this is probably the biggest one. They resist through blaming other people and very often blaming the counselor. To the point that when I go into working with a new client, I say, there's going to be a point at which you're very angry at me. Because what I'm going to do in part is I'm going to be holding up a mirror in front of you so that you'll be able to look and understand and see who you are. And I need to tell you that most people don't like what they see. And what you're going to do probably is get angry at me. And I would like to request that you make a commitment that if you're angry at me, you'll come back one more time and we'll talk about it. Because what happens a lot is people just get angry and they walk away and then they don't have to learn anything. And I think that's such a sad thing. People walk away all the time from employment situations, from marriage situations, from working with their children, and they don't get back the information that they need. That would be so very helpful to them and maybe bring them over the hump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another way people deal with the truth in their lives is not to blame other people, but another side of it is to blame themselves. So when something negative happens, they don't just take on their responsibility for the problem, but they take on far more of the responsibility than is theirs. And they dig such a deep hole for themselves, it's very hard to help them climb out of that hole and to help them see you are a guilty, sinful person and you are loved by God, forgiven by God. You just need to look at your responsibility for what's going on in your life. And that becomes a really difficult tightrope to follow and requires an incredibly good relationship with a person so that they'll be able to hear from me the truth.
Yeah, I think that's important. Sometimes people get the notion that because the Bible teaches the depravity of the human heart, that somehow it's a virtue to just heap all kinds of blame on ourselves, and the more the merrier, and we should just see ourselves as awful, terrible people, period, for the sake of doing that. Well, that's not the Bible's agenda. The Bible's agenda is to face into the truth of who we are, both the good, the glorious, and the bad, and to acknowledge both, and to accept both, and to embrace both as true. So there's certainly nothing wrong in a conflict in identifying the sin of another person, the ways in which they are being cruel, the ways in which they are being thoughtless and unloving and insensitive and so on. I'm not somehow, that's not a dodge. That's not a,
not necessarily blame shifting
if it's true.
Right.
If it's true, then I'm just seeing reality the way that it is.
And it's a necessary reality to see.
Exactly. That's just as important and just as healthy as seeing the sin in myself. Because as I see the truth about all of us, then I become wise. I become discerning. But we're more inclined to see clearly the evil in other people and become somehow blind when it comes to seeing the sin in ourselves. That's why the emphasis there in our previous discussion, because that's where we're most inclined to want to not see it. We don't mind seeing other people as scum, but we don't want to see that about ourselves.
Well, and I think it even gets pretty intricate because although I agree you're right, I'll take this one on for a moment. Sometimes people will see themselves entirely as scum as a way to avoid the reality of seeing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You follow?
Mm-hmm.
And so it looks as though they're not, that they are taking on responsibility, and the reality is they're really not. They're just digging a hole for themselves so they don't have to look at the reality of their lives and work with it.
Yeah, we can see ourselves as worthless because we prefer to see ourselves as worthless to seeing ourselves as sinful, essentially, as blameworthy, as morally accountable.
As somebody who needs to take some actions like, I'm so bad, I'm so terrible, rather than take on the necessary steps for working through an issue with somebody.
Oh, okay. You're actually saying something different, that we're in the moral realm, perhaps, but I'm just such a moral wreck that there's no help for me. And it's useless. No point in trying. I'm such a moral wreck. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think I was saying what you were... I was on the same road as you were before. Somebody who's just saying, I am so terrible, I'm awful, I'm scum.
I'm worthless.
I'm worthless. And they just kind of use that, really, and I don't think consciously, but they use that as a way to avoid having to really work with the nitty-gritty of the relationships or the nitty-gritty of dealing with issues in their own lives. So they just have this blanket, I'm scum, or feel sorry for themselves, and they're not really working with the practical issues of life.
Right. And again, it's important to recognize that's not what the Bible is saying. The Bible is not saying, blessed is the person who thinks he's as bad as possible, as he can imagine. I mean, that's not the perspective. The question is, what's the truth? And the truth is, I'm not worthless. The truth is, I am a rebel against God who is making some self-destructive decisions, some foolish decisions, some rebellious decisions that in part is why my life is as chaotic as it is.
Yes.
And to the extent that I can change my choices, my value system, the goals of my life, to change the agenda of my life, I can actually make some progress in becoming a better person and living a better life.
Yes.
Yeah.
And to the extent that I can become less blind to how I'm doing these things, because you said, no, I'm not worthless, I am valuable, but I am rebellious. But a lot of people don't experience themselves as rebellious.
Right.
Like when my husband said to me, Christine, this is your attitude. Well, I wasn't trying to be rebellious or hurtful in any way. And yet I was, and I needed the blinders taken off my eyes so I could see the reality of what was going on with me. And that's what we as friends, as pastors, as counselors need to be helping other people do. Both see their open rebellion and see the rebellion, help them see the rebellion that they don't see.
Yeah.
And I think it just takes an incredible amount of courage for people to go into their pastor, to talk to their, to have real friends who tell them the truth, or to go to counsel and say, help me see, because I don't see. I just think it's an incredibly courageous thing to do. I'm always pretty much awed at people's willingness to do that. And yet, on the other hand, I don't ever think people get what they're really doing when they come in to see me. I'll tell them, this is probably going to be the most painful thing you ever do if you stick with it. And they go, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. But they'll tell me long time later, wow, you were right. I'm glad you told me that. Because I'd be really mad at you now for what I'm having to look at and see, and yet it's bringing such richness into my life that I wasn't aware I could have in my blind state. Jack, I really like your emphasis that what we're supposed to do in our lives is face into the truth of our lives. Just to summarize what we've been doing, talking about here is we're supposed to face into the truth of our lives, into the truth of our relationships, into the truth about what the world is about, rather than just come up with a simple answer that helps us not have to face what's most difficult. Facing the truth is really difficult. Coming up with a solution, a formula, an easy answer is not ultimately going to bring us to the place where we need to go.
And I think ultimately what motivates that is precisely a desire not to have to face the truth. We have all probably experienced in ourselves, to the extent that we are attracted to formulas and trite answers, the kind of smugness that goes with it, the kind of self-satisfaction that goes with it, the sense that now I've arrived, now I know, now my life is under control, now I can be pleasing to God, now I can be obedient. I've memorized the steps, or I've memorized the answers or the verses or the formulas or whatever. That smugness should be a tip-off that this is not reality, this is not truth. This is a running from truth, not a flight to truth. Because anyone who is seeking truth is going to have a certain humility that is instilled in them with a recognition of how ignorant we are really, how foolish we are, how little we know, how far from having arrived we are. And there's a certain humility that comes from recognizing life is hard and I don't know how to do it right, and God help me. Whenever we see the smugness that I think really now finally I'm arrived, that should be an important danger sign that somebody doesn't want to know the truth.
I think that's really something that I've learned as a counselor is there's just a great deal of humility in the work that I do. I was talking to a friend who's also a counselor, and she says, when I go into a counseling session, I pray, and my prayer is, gasp. And I just think that's so great. And I've never really put it in words that way, but that's very much my prayer. Gasp. I'm walking into the lives of people who really need help here. God, help me to be a tool, because this is bigger than me. That's the kind of humility you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's a gift.
I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. What does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following, the students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. and throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated and sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you're interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College.
As has become our weekly routine, we would like to ask the listening audience to consider supporting us financially if you think that the content and the approach of this program is helpful to you and to other people and therefore worthy of your support. We would be very grateful for any support that you could send our way. We have been humbled and greatly appreciative of both the support that we have received in the past several weeks as well as the wonderful letters that we've received. It's been very encouraging to know that we are connecting with people. We are helping them with not only the content of what we're saying, but particularly, Christine, by your guiding us into the nitty-gritty of life and an honest exposure of what our own Christian lives are all about and what we can expect the Christian faith to look like in people's lives. I want to thank you for that, and it's apparent from the letters that we've received that a number of them are thankful for that as well. I think you have another letter that you could read for us.
I do. I guess in the beginning when we were asking for financial support, it was difficult for me, Jack, much more so than now, because we've been receiving more letters and hearing that people have had a positive impact on their lives. And so it makes me think, well, gosh, I really want to continue this program. I really think it's valuable for these people. And here's another of the letters. I always enjoy listening to your program, broadcasted on Friday evening. The one on April 6, 17 was particularly interesting to me. You spoke about the trials and tribulations of our lives. It was so poignant and spoke so deeply to my heart. The honesty that you both share is so refreshing. The points that you made about children, our perceptions of them, their ingratitude, our expectations, all of it was so right on point, and I was especially appreciative about the way you both articulated your experiences. Thank you so much. So there's another letter of gratitude, and again, I'd like to encourage people to please write in your experiences with the program. Let us know what's going on in your lives as you listen to the program.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. 1-800-273-8101. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.